People are pretty familiar with the people they hear on radio and see on television, but a lot of them don't realize, and it's not their fault, that there's a lot of people behind the scenes that make it happen. And among the most important of those people, not to denigrate anyone's job, but are the engineers, the people who make, install, look after, and make sure it's running 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, so that the broadcast that you listen to can get out. One of the senior engineers who worked for a very long time at CKNW here in Vancouver is Dave Glassteter.
Hello.
You started in engineering a long time ago.
Well, my history with CKNW actually goes back to when I was about 6 years old. Unbeknownst to me, I had a friend across the street from my place that had a birthday. Way back in those days, CKNW was located in the second floor of the Windsor Hotel down on Columbia Street in New Westminster, and they had a birthday club. Well, we ended up going down there and celebrating his birthday. I remember driving with his parents into the back parking lot and climbing these wooden fire escape stairs up to the second floor, and that was my first time I had ever seen a radio station. Well, none of us kids had seen one. There were three very interesting guys there. One played the guitar, another one played the accordion, and another one played a bass fiddle. It wasn't many years later I found out that it was Mike, Mark, and Jack, the Rhythm Pals. I don't know who was running the control board, but I was fascinated by this great big blue thing that sat upright, and it had one great big meter in the middle and a whole bunch of round dials. After the party, we went home, and we used to have a blackboard in our kitchen, and I drew with chalk a picture of that control panel, and for hours on end, I'd sit there and just play with the control knobs with the chalk. Never thought too much more of it, other than that it was a very interesting thing. I'd always been mechanical right from a very early age. My father never withheld the tools and the workbench. I can remember taking a hacksaw and cutting right across a couple of boards in the workbench as far as the blade would carry me. And he never said a word, always stood back and smiled and watched me do it. So that was my first run into the technical things. Down the line from there, I grew up in South Vancouver, attended John Oliver High School. I always took shop courses, electricity, automotive, metalwork, and all of those things. Really enjoyed that kind of thing, but never ever thought too much about the electronic end. And it wasn't till a number of years later that, even fact, after I got married and had one child, that jobs were easy to come by. In fact, back in the era of the early 60s, the middle 60s, jobs were plentiful. If you didn't like what you were doing, in the morning you picked up a newspaper, and by 1 in the afternoon you had another job. And so my focus was really not in a career until I started working for a paper converting plant out in Richmond. And I ended up driving a forklift, and that seemed like a neat thing to do. And it wasn't until I realized that the guy next to me driving the other forklift was retiring the next day, and he'd been there some 40 years, and what I was looking forward to was exactly what he was doing. So that was a bit of a wake-up call. I remember years earlier attending John Oliver High School, and we had vocational day. And in vocational day, you could always take and go and sign up to listen to these people who worked in the industry come in and give you a little bit of a pep talk on why their kind of job was the best and this is something you should aim for. I can remember the guy from Vancouver Vocational Institute, the technical director there at the time. His name was Ken Wheeler. He came out and gave us a chat, told us it was a tough course and not to take it unless you were really serious. And so I gave that up. Back then, when you were in high school, by the time you got to grade 9, you had to pick the direction you were going. You could either be university material or you could end up on the vocational end. And I took the vocational end. Well, back to when I had my eyes open and looking for a career now, I decided that maybe electronics was a way to go. So I went down to vocational school. They promptly told me that my vocational entrance finality in the high school end didn't qualify me for getting into the vocational school, and that I needed some extra courses like physics and real heavy-duty mathematics. But he said if you want to tackle a course, if there's room at the end of the course and there isn't enough applicants for the next course, we'll let you give it a try. But don't count on passing. I took the challenge. The long and the short of it was that at the end of the one-year course, I and one other fella tied for the top honors in the class. He went to the CBC, and I went to CKNW. That was back in January. Well, we graduated December of 66. I started looking for work. At CKNW, previous to that, they had an engineer who had met an untimely demise. His name was Bob Vogt. He had been with CKNW about 6 years, had come through Vancouver Vocational, and had been picked by the chief engineer of CKNW at the time, whose name was Jack Gordon. Ended up by going home from work one night late, as a lot of us engineers have done, and fell asleep at the wheel and drove off the road and was sadly killed. And Jack Gordon, ended up looking for another engineer, and he ended up doing an interview with me over the telephone. Never had done anything like this before. In fact, most of my training at vocational school was quite interesting. You talk about taking technical training in tubes and transistors. The first 6 months of our course was all tube theory. These are those glass things that glow in the dark and get mighty warm. The course then switched gear at the halfway point to transistors. So we got a bit of the good stuff from both ends. The tube theory actually came back years later to be a real benefit to me. And I started with CKNW on January the 4th, 1967, in their studios at 227 Columbia Street in New Westminster. There was probably, I was the fourth engineer in line, the bottom of the totem pole. One of my first jobs at the radio station, and I was a little taken back, but they got a call in engineering. And back then, engineers did everything. You weren't classified as a tube guy or a transistor guy or a repair guy. A call came into the engineering office, and somebody on the other end said, can you send somebody down with a plunger? The women's washroom is all plugged up. Well, guess who got that? And that was my indoctrination after 1 year of service in engineering at the vocational school, that I was chief plunger man. It ended up being more or less one of my jobs that I had to do. The other one was taking once a week, setting the old IBM pendulum clock to WWV and getting the time set up properly. That clock ended up driving a time tone, which was quite famous back then at CKNW. You could always set your clock to it. The time tone you knew was plus or minus 1 second from National Bureau of Standards. And so a lot of things like that. My shifts ended up being Monday, or actually I had Monday and Tuesday off because I worked Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday as an afternoon shift. Saturday and Sunday I was the remote guy, and which meant that you got home after midnight on Friday night and you were up by 6 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and heading out to wherever they had that great big miserable Crystal Palace that ended up over the years being modified and copied and so on and so forth. And in fact, that old mobile studio still today is used as a platform for community services and things out at in Port Coquitlam.
What type of equipment were you working with back then? What did you have in the studios?
Well, coming from the vocational school, and we had very little, the course I took had very little to do with broadcasting as such. It was generally theory, and we worked on television cameras, and we had an old cast-off Western Electric 1 kilowatt tube transmitter that the CBC so generously donated us out of the old Hotel Vancouver. But the equipment back then, commercials were either on reel-to-reel tape, and you ran those in the control room on the Ampex 601s. You had cart machines, which were Spotmaster or Tapecaster, and you actually recorded commercials on these plastic cartridges made by a company called Fidelipak, and one drop on the floor, and they were gone. And we had literally thousands of those. CKNW was a very competitive station, a very, very financially successful station, and so consequently, a lot of stuff ended up on cart. We had probably the equipment, the cart machines, when they came in. We never actually took anything out of the box and plugged it in and worked. It had to go through a whole battery of tests. If something wasn't working correctly or you had a modification for it, it was always done. And this was according to Jack Gordon's standards. Jack was a very fastidious engineer. He was a teacher. I just can't say enough about how this guy taught. To work for, he was miserable. If you didn't do it Jack's way, it was the highway. The thing that always got you with Jack, and I've seen many, many guys in the past try to outguess him, is that in Jack's mind, he was always right. And the thing that really hurt is he was right. And Jack had a philosophy that the right way is what's left after you've done everything wrong. And he kind of lived by that. We ended up by using the consoles that were there when I arrived were made by Jack. The transmitter control systems were made by him. There was very little original equipment that came from the factory that was used or just came out of the box and ended up being modified. So that's what we ended up doing. We had one or two small production studios, the on-air studio. To get to the shortcut to the men's washroom was through the master control. And this was interesting because our newsroom at that time was probably no more than 12 feet deep or 12 feet wide and maybe 15 feet long. And there was two newsmen working on there, a bank of teletypes. The old curmudgeon of a sports broadcaster was in there too. And anytime those guys had to go to the washroom, it was right through the main control room, out the back end, and into the washroom. So for studios, it wasn't ideal, but we learned a lot, and that was the place that we had to stay until 1969, at which time we were involved. We took over an old Safeway building at 8th and McBride. Fortunately, I was quite mechanical. Jack Gordon saw this. We ended up working on that building for about 6 months before we actually moved in. I was taken off my old duties for remotes, which I was very glad to get rid of, and ended up by building equipment. I love to do this, and Jack would come in with a design, and we also hired a professional engineer at that time who came from, I think he started with Lenkert, and then he was through with BCTEL, a fellow by the name of Don Kalmakoff, which still he's residing in retirement over in Nanaimo. We ended up building a whole lot of equipment, doing the installation on the new studio, and in January of 69, we moved into that building from Columbia Street in the midst of a howling snowstorm. It was a great place. One radio station, and that was all we moved. And we had room for building other ones. CFMI came a couple of years later, and it was a very interesting place. We ended up by one of the philosophies of engineering with CKNW, and I never knew any different what went on in other radio stations. The thing that we did is that we were very heavily program-driven. A lot of other radio stations, if you needed a piece of equipment, the engineer went shopping in the catalog, found what best matched the piece of equipment that they needed, and bought it, and that's what they used.
But it was never perfect.
Of course. Never was perfect. Never exactly what we wanted. We ended up by being, as I said, program-driven, and the program director, who was Hal Davis at the time, would come to us, and he would say, you know, guys, we need to do this. This is the function that we need. What can you do to accommodate that? And of course, we'd go back and huddle, and Jack would go into seclusion for the better part of a week, come back in with a whole set of drawings, and we built this and we built that. I remember intercom systems, which were very hard to come by way back in the old days. We developed our own intercom system, and it was a beauty. A lot of other things we ended up doing, as I mentioned, transmitter control systems. Jack was very heavy into design with solid state devices, and our first console, portable console that he built, he bought a Northern Electric console that had two turntables built into the top, took the turntables off, took everything off the inside of the console and sent it back and kept the shell. And for about 6 months later, Jack came in with the circuits, and we ended up building a solid state portable console, which, by the way, now resides in the Hornby Island radio community and is one of the boards that they use up there. It ended up getting relegated to the garbage heap. I just couldn't see this thing disappearing, and so I ended up salvaging old equipment like that, refurbishing it, and then donating it to different radio societies that were looking for things. But that's what we ended up doing. The consoles that we had at the time were tube type with Northern amps, ended up by having all the control surfaces and the switches designed by Jack, and it was a beauty.
I've seen a board that looks similar to a McCurdy with, I think, 24 rotary pots on it.
That's an interesting... That was something Jack designed. That was put in master control of CKNW at the 8th and McBride studios. Each one of those controls, there was a key and a rotary pot, and you could take this module out of the board using a penny to just flip these little key locks, and there was always a spare one around. There was no electronics in it. The board was a high-level input with a couple of makeup amplifiers. The other thing that we designed for a lot of the on-air people who didn't like to wear headphones was full-volume monitoring. So we developed back then part of the mix-minus system, where your disc jockey could listen to his music and get the feel of it and turn his mic on and talk over top of it, and there was no feedback. And that board actually still exists today. I believe it's out at the Broadcast Museum in Coquitlam. They use it out there, along with another old board that was Jack Cullen's, an old Northern Electric. That's a lot of great stuff. In fact, they were the Broadcast Museum was the recipient of a whole lot of the equipment that we got rid of when we left the 8th and McBride and moved downtown to the Toronto Dominion Tower.
That system of not actually having anything in the control surface was sort of a keynote of the way things were built at CKNW. Even when you went to, I guess, we're going to talk about the new building in a few minutes anyway, but talking about the way it was set up there, the control surfaces basically had the switches and the pots on them, but all the amps were in a rack.
Yeah, we did a lot of that. These amps actually were in a space behind the console on part of the millwork. One of the reasons for that is that we had a number of on-air people. Back then, you could smoke in the control room, you could
spill
drink.
Spill pop.
Oh, everything. there was many a screaming call into engineering on the intercom system saying, hey, you know, I just spilled my coffee all over the board, and you know, what am I going to do? And basically we'd say, just keep on going, it'll work. And we'd come in with the spray clean and the wiping rags, and I'd always threaten to build a board that had a gutter built in the edge, and that gutter had a drain hole right where you sit, and your orange juice goes into that and you got it on your pants. But never quite got that yet. We ended up developing other boards. The other one, I worked with McCurdy for a bit of time, building, it had them design a strip line board for us that had actually 24 strip line modules. And that one did have electronics, but the beauty of that is that McCurdy had a company called McCurdy Metal Form, and they were very good at doing the fabrication of the metal, and they could actually build a strip that would plug in and be so tight a fit and yet wouldn't stick that nothing would flow down in between the cracks. Consequently, you drop a coffee on that thing and it rolled right down over the bottom and onto you. So that didn't happen too often, but those boards were interesting, and that was one of the forerunners of the McCurdy line. And there was only one of those boards built, and when we moved out of 8th and McBride, there was a lot of fight from some guys to get that, and we got a good price for it on a resale.
Well, there are a couple of big projects that came about. One was Expo, and the other was moving downtown to 700 West Georgia.
Well, they never happened at the same time, although one of the things way back in, we'd have to, Expo was in 86. We didn't move downtown till 96. We got the word from management that we were, in fact, moving. We didn't know where, we didn't know when. So for about 8 to 10 years, everything we bought for the radio station ended up going in on the basis that at any time it could be unplugged and moved. We wouldn't end up having to be inconvenienced by something that was built in. So we knew that was going to happen. Expo in 86 was a very, very interesting time. Some of our salespeople and those in charge in the news could see this coming. One of the big proponents of our move to Expo was our manager at the time, Ted Smith, who ended up giving us basically carte blanche to build what we needed to build down there. We had our open line studios at the time down at the Holiday Inn Harbor side. It was on the top of a building just below a rotating restaurant. It was slowly outgrowing its usefulness because initially that studio was just designed for a morning show. By the time we got to Expo, we had a morning talk show, an afternoon talk show, and an evening show, and we ended up gobbling up more space in the Holiday Inn than we could actually conveniently use. We almost had to put studios on different floors. So Expo was going to be the place we were going to relocate this studio. The other thing that we had downtown is one of the difficulties that we had was New Westminster was our main studio, and the CRTC back then, their ruling was that your main programming had to come from your main licensed area, and CKNW was a New Westminster licensed radio station. And so our remote stations, initially when I started, we had an open line studio with Jack Webster in the Georgia Hotel. Then we moved to the Holiday Inn Harborside, and then finally over to the Expo site. That ended up being more than one studio. In fact, we actually had three there. And the other thing too is that we had a fairly large office for the producers, all that ends up going with an open line show. Our newsroom, we used to operate a bit out of the courthouse. Well, when that closed at night, you were stuck. The Expo Studios on Pacific Avenue ended up being a good place to have a fully functional news operation, and so we put in a newsroom there. During Expo, we were the broadcast station for Expo, and there was a number of radio stations from all across the world that contracted with us for studio space to do their radio broadcasts. John Ashbridge took manning of this and coordinated all of that. The other thing is we had mobile systems on the Expo grounds. We could do broadcasts literally from anywhere at any time. And it was a very exciting time. We also had a fully operational boardroom down there that would seat close to 20 people. Our salesmen that worked in Vancouver, they ended up by using that studio, and it just grew and grew. Well, it went and a lot of times 24 hours a day, depending on who was operating there. The downside of it was that after Expo, that site almost became a graveyard. And we stayed there from when we moved in. I believe it was just a month before Expo opened in 86. We stayed there right until June or July of 96 when we moved downtown. One of the other problems we had down there too is a great big disco right next to us. And when we moved in, you almost had to time your commercials and everything amongst all the noise and thumping of the walls. They told us at that time that, wow, they're only going to be there for Expo, and after Expo, they'll be gone. Well, that wasn't the case, and they probably are still there.
The big project, the one that was very involved, a lot of planning, a lot of work, a lot of challenges, getting into a high-rise on the 20th and 21st floors of the TD Tower at 700 West Georgia. That's a huge space. There's a whole floor of nothing but studios and record library at the time, the engineering shop. That must have been a tremendous challenge. I don't even know how many control rooms and studios are on that floor. There's a ton of them.
CRTC finally reluctantly gave up their criteria that your main broadcast studios had to be in your city of license. And so I think it was one of the Rogers group that kind of pioneered that and stuck their foot out and moved from one place to the other. And that kind of threw that regulation out of the window. And in hindsight, we did, even though the programming and the commercials all came through New Westminster, it didn't start there. It ended up by being coming from the Expo site. So then the criteria was is that we always wanted to put a radio station, all of our facilities, under one roof. You had the open line people, which worked downtown. You had the sales people that worked sometimes in New Westminster, and we had sales offices in Vancouver, and it was we had a lot of rental properties going at that time in different areas. The thing that we wanted to do is put it all under one roof. We looked at probably no less than 12 to 15 different locations in Greater Vancouver. One of them was in the Bentall Center. Another one was up at 2nd in Quebec. There was even places where River Rock is in Richmond now. That was another possibility. But management worked out a deal with the Cadillac Fairview people at the Pacific Center that we could get two floors of radio station space in the Toronto Dominion Tower at the corner of Georgia and Granville. That's the big black tower. Not knowing what we would need to do, we entered into negotiations for space in there. There was a number of floors that were available to us, and going price wasn't too bad. At that time in downtown Vancouver, you had a lot of companies that had manufacturing facilities out into the Fraser Valley, and their head office was downtown, and they were moving head offices out to the valley area where they could all be working in one area. So we ended up by getting actually 34,000 square feet on two floors in the TD Tower. We took floor 20 and 21. One of the things as we were going through it, this just started to get more difficult as time went on. We found out that the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning system in the building shut off at 7 o'clock. And as the TD Tower was typically a business venture, nobody was in the building after 7 except cleaning people, and nobody got there before 6 in the morning. So they shut down the air conditioning system. Well, when you build soundproof studios, you gotta have air. And so part of the thing was is that we had torn out the whole HVAC system for floors 20 and 21. We had to negotiate for extra space up on the 30th floor in the mechanical room to put our cooling tower and our refrigeration systems and the water pumps and all of this kind of stuff. The other thing that we wanted to do is to be able to, from a technical end, to be able to shoot to our transmitter sites with a microwave. And there was a beautiful clear shot right up to Seymour Mountain, and we took advantage of that. And we ended up with the majority of the roof rights, ended up with our own HVAC system, and plus we ended up putting in a humongous big 250 kilowatt diesel generator up on the roof. That ended up being the basis for our studios. We started occupancy of the building in, I believe it was the fall of 94, and we worked down there, oh goodness, all of the engineering staff, probably We only had Christmas and New Year's off. This went for almost 2 years. We were a pretty tired group at one time, but we did a lot of building of our own equipment. We brought in extra staff to do manufacturing. We put the Wynn Radio network uplink on the roof. That had some interesting things going for it. When your building sways 9 inches in a 60 kilometer an hour wind, and you try and keep your satellite dish pinned down, there was a lot of technical things that went with that that really tried us. And we basically took the attitude that it all could be done. It just took a little time, a little extra money. We had the budget for the whole building was about $5.5 million, and we came in just underneath that on a projected budget that was done 2 years previous to that. The number of control rooms, we didn't build our own control boards at that time. We actually looked at a company called Ward Beck, had a lot of meetings with them and a lot of meetings with their engineers, and wanted them to develop and build for us a console that would be worthy of what we had in the past. When you're coming in with an order for 22 consoles, they look very favorably on something like that. In fact, I think we were their full production run for almost a year. We got a Ward Beck board with the extension on the name of NW. Mm-hmm. So it worked out very well. We had, for Open Line, we ended up with a beautiful studio with a beautiful view looking west. That's one thing that we never had in a lot of the places we went to, and it's still commented on. There was proper workspace for all the producers. Engineering ended up with 4 different rack rooms. We ended up by putting 750 miles of cable into that building, and the Cat5 computer cable, we ended up putting 150,000 lineal feet of that in. That was by construction end in 1996 to 1997, and they've even added to that now.
This is when computers started to come in and change the game pretty much completely.
Oh, you can do all of that, and one cable per studio mm-hmm. is pretty well what you need now, and a few other peripheral things, but there was one of the criteria was is that we could do a lot of cable changes and everything in one room. You didn't have to climb into the ceiling, and you didn't have to go to each individual control room. We also ended up developing a telephone system, and this was a beauty. It was done in conjunction with a chap that came from Duncan on Vancouver Island. It was a computerized controlled telephone system. We wanted to be able to put 24 lines on air simultaneously if we so chose to. We never did. We only got about 8 or 9 on, but there was, I remember Rafe Mayer used to have a program that ran at Christmas time where he'd get a whole bunch of people dialing in who wanted to sing, and they would all sing Christmas carols. It was terrible. That's we designed stuff like that. The other thing you could do is you could go out on remote with your full telephone board and from a remote facility do everything that you could do in the studio. It was just on the cusp of getting computerized. I hired a fellow back in the early 90s that was a computer programmer and very sharp in computers, and we used to lock him in a room and feed him underneath the door, and he'd come up with different computer designs. He developed a cable numbering system. Well, when you get 750 miles of cable on, you better put a number on this cable so you know where it's going. And Bob ended up doing this and developing a computer program that wouldn't let you issue 2 numbers the same, and you could follow one cable from one end of the building all the way through to the other end, and it was just a beauty of a program. But we had the attitude and the criteria at that point in time is that nothing was installed ever unless you had a plan, you had a file folder for it, a project number, and a cable number. And woe betide anybody that tried to jury-rig a wire from here to there without those things in. The only guy that was ever caught doing that was me.
As a fellow engineer, though, I was incredibly impressed the first time I saw the CKNW facilities, and that was probably in 2002, that all the control surfaces were identical in the control rooms, or as near to identical as they could be. So you could walk into any one of those control rooms and immediately be able to use the board.
Well, that was the thing, is to keep it simple, and that's why we went with one manufacturer. The other thing is your backup and spares. Those boards now are no longer made, yet we ended up buying one extra console, which was kept in the shop.
Sits in the shop.
And that was our test bay. When you try to get management to put an extra $22,000 into the budget for a piece of gear like that that isn't going to bring them too much, you got to be quite convincing. And so we ended up by doing a lot of stuff like that. If a module went in the control room, Frosty spilt something on it, we ended up by running in there in 2 seconds, we could have the thing popped out. The other thing with computers, as they were coming in, our whole commercial system ended up being on computer. And it worked great for most of the time. And when you look at computer statistics and you read reliability information, they say, well, this computer is going to be 99.9% reliable. But when you work that out into a broadcast day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, that 0.1% ends up representing 12 hours. So you can't tell a program director that 99.9% of the time it'll work, and 12 hours a year you're going to lose commercial. So what we ended up doing is that we duplicated computers in each control room so that at a flick of a switch, if one didn't go, another one came up on your screen, you had a second screen, everything backed up. And as they wrote the commercials and produced them in the production studios, they would go into the main server and get recorded there, and they would show up in the control room. I guess one of the last things we ended up putting on there was probably all the music for the FM stations. The other thing I might add is when we went into Pacific Center, there was CKNW and CFMI, or Rock 101. By the time we had finished, and this was a bit of an interesting thing on the part of the people that owned CKNW, which was WIC at the time, Western International Communications, their criteria through the CRTC was that there was going to be licensing available to purchase or create a second AM and a second FM in your market. So we had room set out. Little did we know that we were going to be the guys that would be bought out at a later date by, initially it was Shaw, and then they quickly formed Chorus. We were going to be bringing in CFOX and CKLG. That was one of the last things that I did in up to April of 2001, is that we had 4 radio stations on the 21st floor of the TD Tower, and we basically had a full house.
The other thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that CKNW has an auxiliary transmitter on the top of that building.
Yes, they do. They've got a 400-watt licensed transmitter that transmits into that 75-foot Velcom antenna. If we lose a link all the way out to our main transmitter, which is out in Cloverdale, you can throw that on in an emergency. We haven't had... So far, I don't know if they've used it, but it was interesting setting it up. NW used to have a ham radio station when I was there. I was one of the guys that ended up getting a ham radio license for lack of something to do. We had that there, and we could broadcast and receive information, which was quite interesting. If those of you who remember Y2K, which didn't happen, we spent a ton of money on backup systems, and it was also a good time for us to end up getting some new equipment that we needed and upgrades, so we took full advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things we talked about earlier, we just touched on, carts. The CKNW engineering department came up with something better, which was internationally adopted. Tell us a little bit about the Aristo cart.
The Aristocart, this was back in probably towards the end of 69-70. CFMI went on the air as a country and western radio station. It had an automation system that was produced by a company in Bellingham called International Good Music, or IGM for short. They also had a music service. And at that time, Bill Hughes was the station manager. They got the license on the premise that they would be a country and western station. I think it lasted less than a week. And of course, the music would come from IGM on these great big 14-inch reels, and you basically played one tune as it appeared after the other. One of the things they wanted to do with music is random select. Well, you can't do that with a reel-to-reel tape machine, so they tried using Fidelipak. The reason to go FM was the reason to have stereo, and stereo was all the big rage back then. We tried recording stereo on the Fidelipak. It didn't work. You probably got one cart out of 10 that had good enough phase characteristics for you to do that. So we set up a kind of an R&D group. This was headed by Jack Gordon and Don Kalmakoff, another fella that worked with us for a number of years, Dick DePalma, and myself. And we all had expertise in different areas. Me being the tinkerer on the lathe and the milling machine and the drill press, I ended up doing a lot of the modifications to old Fidelipaks to make them work. And we actually flipped the acceptance rate to getting 9 out of 10 on those that would work. It was kind of a complicated process I won't go into, but we could make them work. But once again, one drop on the floor and they were done. So we had the option of trying to build, and in hindsight, we should have never done this, but because you don't know better, you do a lot of things and sometimes you win. So we decided to build a cartridge. And the first one we built was a prototype cart that was made out of bits of plastic glued together using some principles that Jack Gordon and Don Kalmakoff came up with to make the thing have a good phase characteristic. And it worked. Next was to take the cartridge down to a plastics manufacturer. There was one that was kind of hungry in New Westminster called Bendorf Manufacturing. Walter Bendorf took one look at this thing and he said, oh yeah, I can make one of those. And he knew how to make male and female molds and put them together. And he says, what would you like to use for the plastic? And we said, well, what have you got that doesn't break? And he says, well, plastic always breaks. We've got some styrene, but it tends to, at different temperatures, it will kind of mold and warp. But he says, I have a bag of these plastic pellets that I just got from General Electric. And he says, I've been dying to try them, and I think I'll try them on your project. Lo and behold, the stuff in the bag was Lexan, the same stuff at the time they were making astronauts' helmets out of. And you could do anything with that stuff. And so he made the first cartridge, the mold for the cartridge. It took about 3 or 4 months to make it. To the credit of the management of CKNW, they funded the bill for this, which was about $30,000 to $40,000 to build a mold. The mold was called a soft mold. If you want a real good mold, then the price goes up, and that's a case hardened mold that you can get basically tens of thousands of these cartridges out of. And he came out with that cartridge and it worked great. There was a few small things that needed to be done to your cart machine. We ended up by developing the Aristocart. Over the years, the next couple of years, there was a lot of refinements. One of the things is that companies wanted these cartridges, and the guys that wanted the most were IGM and Bellingham. They were selling a cartridge player that held 48 cartridges. They were using these things, can you believe, in all things like time announcement machines in airports. They would put in dozens of these big machines, and each cartridge would have a different hour on it. So when they were doing a time announcement, you just selected in a program sequence, the cartridges that would say flight 602 leaving Seattle at such and such a time, runway and whatever. This was before computers took that over, and so they were the biggest buyers of that. But that cartridge ended up being sold in Australia, all over the U.S. It was interesting to watch TV programs like WKRP in Cincinnati and look at the wall of cartridges and saying, ah, that's an Aristocrat. They had them there even for the movie set.
The other pioneering thing that CKNW was deeply involved in because of the WINS radio network was pioneering the satellite technology for connecting the stations, uploads, downloads, and all the rest of that sort of thing, which developed into the WIC radio network, which then became the Chorus radio network, distributing programs, distributing news clips, all of the rest of that. That must have been a pretty exciting time, too, just replacing all those wires with some dishes.
The original news network was done all on leased lines. CNCP Telecommunications, BCTEL at the time, whatever you could beg, borrow, steal, or lease came into the line. There was also some stations that could never take advantage of a full spectrum audio file because there was just not, there was only what they call loaded pairs available into their area. Back then, we ended up by doing a lot of research with a company called NorSat International that was based out in Surrey. They came up, they actually had leased chunks of C-band satellite space with from Telesat. They came up with a satellite transmitting and receiving system that would allow us to carry 7 15 kilohertz stereo channels. And that's just like you've died and gone to heaven. So they built these receivers, which were very expensive, and being on C-band and also being wideband consumed a chunk of satellite space that back then rented for about $24,000 a month. And that's a telephone bill or a satellite bill that you don't want to see too often. But we needed it, and up it went. And we put in receivers into every radio station. The WIC stations in Western Canada all got them. And then the stations that were on the Western Information News Network all got them. Over a period of a couple of years, they ended up by condensing the amount of space that this satellite space that you were required for their system, and we were moved up into the KU band. Our satellite costs ended up dropping to about $5,000 to $6,000 a month, which was great. And with people like Ray Dagg, who was formerly from Target Media and was in the network business with WIC, him and John Ashbridge developed a program system whereby radio stations who were on the network would get things like all the hockey, all the football, the news comments, sports comments, in return for their unused airtime that they had on their radio station. And then Ray would bag them together as a national spot and sell it to people that were like the Bay and Woodward's and Eaton's. Back then, many times these stations ended up getting all of their broadcast time and all the features and everything they had for next to nothing. In fact, there was a few stations that used to even make money on it. Nobody could ever figure out how that worked, but it ended up doing very well.
And that sort of now is gone into the background when along comes the computer and the internet getting better and faster and more versatile every day. All you need now is a computer and an internet connection. You can send high-quality audio anywhere and bring it in from anywhere. And instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on equipment, like we used to do on 78 RPM turntables, tube boards, big Ampex tape machines, and all the rest of it, you can spend $400 on a computer and do practically anything with it. Changed amazingly.
Well, it ended up by, over the years, satellite ended up getting dropped in favor of fiber optic. And then, of course, like you say, Mike, then comes the computer. It just became such a marvel that you could get up on the internet, fire out these news clips, or you could log in from a remote location. Newsmen could be sitting in the courthouse with a laptop on their lap, going through a court session, typing down notes, email them back to the radio station. Another guy put in some audio with that, and it just boggles the mind. You never know where this thing is going to end.
Who are some of the your favorite people that you got to work with, either engineers or other people in the business over the years?
There were some real interesting people. Jack Gordon was probably one of my favorites. He took the time to teach me. One of the things that was even more than that, he taught me how to think. That was the key for solving a lot of technical problems. Other people that were in the business, and I have to mention in our engineering group, there was Doug Court, who was there when I started and recently just passed away. There was always liked to work with John Ashbridge. John was the guy that had a computer brain. I remember sitting in my office and I'd yell down the hall, "John, what's the phone number of the Quesnel radio station?" Right off the top of his head, he could tell you their phone number, their fax number, what their address was, their postal code, and who was the program director, the engineer, and the manager at any one time. And he hasn't changed at all in that. A lot of on-air guys that were interesting. I won't say they were my favorites, but I remember Webster. He was still there when I started. Ran into him many years ago over at BCTV. There was guys like Gary Bannerman. The stories you could tell about those guys. Al Davidson. Oh, did him and I ever tangle. We had many a confrontation, but I liked old Al. He was great. The guy that I appreciated a lot in managers were Hal Davis. I left CKNW in 74 for 2 years, 10 months, and 3 days, and went out to be chief engineer of the Langley radio station, CJJC. And Hal told me the day I left, he said, "If you ever want to come back," he says, "just give me a call." Well, that day came, and I picked up the phone, and the following Monday, I was back at CKNW. You know, it was just a great working relationship with those guys. Ted Smith was another one. Ted asked me at one time, he says, "I want you to be chief engineer of the radio station." I said, "You know, I'm not ready for that." He says, "Well," he says, "okay, then tell me who we can get." And I thought about that for a minute, and I figured, well, whoever we get, I'm going to have to train. I'll take the job. Ted and I had developed a real good relationship over the years. We used to end up doing field strength readings off the stern of his boat up an Indian Arm. That was, he'd take the whole engineering group out for an afternoon on the water. He was a great guy. And, you know, even all the way down to the janitor of the building, old Reg Banfield, who became a part of the NW scene for many years. It just, you know, there's a lot of these guys, even the newer management. I really like working for Chris Pandoff. He was a great guy. But there was a point in time, it just got to the place where we had to separate our ways.
Now, you officially retired in the early part of this century. Was it 2001, 2000?
I gave my notice, and just kind of to go back, the engineering abilities of CKNW were changing. We were now owned by a company in the East. There was less input from management. I was back in the early 90s, I was made a vice president of technical operations for WIC, for CKNW. It was actually a position that was shown on the company books. When you get bought out by another company, there's always a little bit of house cleaning that goes on. But there was a different philosophy in Chorus, and not to say that it was wrong or right, it was probably right for the time, and radio was changing. And a lot of the guys that worked in radio at that time ended up by telling you the same thing, is that radio had changed. And for a lot of us that grew up in the fun time of radio, the fun was not there anymore. I long learned that if you don't enjoy doing what you're doing, then, you know, it's going to tell on your health and the rest of it. It's going to, you're going to come out the loser for it. So in April of 2001, we parted ways, and I went into what I thought was going to be retirement. I was looking forward to this. One of the things I didn't like in the move to downtown was the commute to my place here in Cloverdale. It was an hour and a half going in, and the same thing coming out day after day after day. After a while, you were just kind of shell-shocked. And when you looked at the number of hours you spent on the road, it was just getting to be a little bit too much, and the fun was gone. The other thing is being technical director. For me, I ended up by doing a lot of design work, overseeing projects, and then handing these projects off to my guys to do while I went on to the next project. And the fun part of building was gone. I just didn't see the fun of it anymore, so it was time to go and look for a different adventure, and so I left in April.
You're doing some work still with a good old friend of mine, and you've worked with my brother on putting a new station on the air in Kelowna recently, so you're sort of maybe semi-retired.
Well, I thought retirement was going to be the deal. I was going to do a lot of boating.
Ride your bike?
Ride the bike, do whatever. After 3 or 4 months, the job jar at home here was empty. I'd wake up in the morning and wondering, well, what am I going to do today? And by about 10 o'clock, he always had tons of stuff to do that didn't really matter. You were just filling time.
Yep.
My wife finally cornered me one day and she said, look, Dave, you either get out and get a job or get out. And so I took that rather seriously, as you've got to do when your spouse says something like that. And I formed a little company, didn't incorporate it. It was Dave Glassdetter Broadcast Technical Services. And I banged on a few doors. And so I did this for about a year and a half. Did some work for CFUN, did some work actually back for Chorus, helped put in the transmitter site for CKLG at the time, which ended up being an all news kind of a thing. Whatever I did, I was always kind of competing against this other company in town, the Stan Davis Broadcast Technical Services. So one day I went and knocked on the door of Dan Roach, said, do you need any help? Said, I only want to work 2 or 3 days a week. And he said, glad to have you. So 5 years ago, that's what I've been doing. And it suits me just fine.
Well, you, Dan, I think my brother, I don't know how many other engineers still know how to work on an AM tube transmitter. I think there's only about 2 or 3 people left in the province who do that.
Well, one of the things that Broadcast Technical does is that we cater to the broadcast people who can't afford to put in the best. Mind you, we're capable of doing the best, and we've done a number of FM stations that have put in top-notch equipment, but for the smaller stations that are existing that don't have full engineering staff, we provide a service. And most of those stations have transmitters that are 25, 30, and 35 years old. We refurbish those things where we've taken transmitters, for instance, out of Prince George and Quesnel, refurbished them and put them into a station that's operating out in Richmond now, AM 1240, or 1200 rather. Do a lot of work there. We will do studio work. I do just about everything. I enjoy constructing equipment for AM 1200. I did all the tuning and phasing. Never done that before, and ended up building it right in my garage at home. My neighbors were really, they would wonder, they thought these great big aluminum panels with these copper tubing on it. I was making a still, yeah.
There are good engineers, there are bad engineers, and there are great engineers, and it's been my pleasure to sit down with one of the great engineers, speaking as one engineer to another, a man I have always admired on the same level as the guy who taught me everything I know, Art Vipond at CKOV in Kelowna back in 1961. A great pleasure, sir.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.